I call the House Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Thursday, March 5th, 2020, and the time is 1:36. Members present, Representative LeBon, Representative Tilton, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Wall, Representative Josephson, Representative Merrick, and myself, Representative Jennifer Johnston. Today's agenda is House Bill 127, Dental Hygienist Advanced Practice Permit, House Bill 182, Sexual Assault Examination Kit Testing, and HB 30, Workman's Comp, Death, Permanent Partial Impairment. House Bill 127, an act relating to the practice of dental hygiene, establishing advanced practice permit, prohibiting unfair discrimination under group health insurance against a dental hygienist who holds an advanced practice permit relating to medical assistance for dental hygiene services and providing for effective date. For the bill reintroduction, Representative Sponholz and her staff, Casey Desort. Would you like to come to the table and introduce yourself and put your names on the record?
Good afternoon. Thank you, Co-Chair. HB 127 creates an advanced practice permit, which would allow dental hygienists to provide care for underserved populations at senior centers, healthcare facilities, daycares, and schools, and for Alaskans who are eligible for public assistance, homebound, or serve in an underserved community. It would be available for dental hygienists who have a minimum of 4,000 hours of clinical experience and who are approved by the Alaska Board of Dental Examiners. Dental hygienists, Alaska wouldn't be the first state to make these changes. Dental hygienists are able to practice under advanced practice permits or similar permits in 6 other states, and in 40 other states are considered direct access states, meaning dental hygienists can initiate treatment based on their assessment of a patient's need without the authorization or the presence of a dentist.
Thank you. Are there any questions before we go on to public testimony? Okay, I'd like to open public testimony. Is there anybody in the room or online that wishes to testify? And if so, could you please introduce yourself to put your name on the record?
Hello, my name is Dominic Wenzel.
Yes.
Hello, thank you, committee. I am a dentist on the Alaska Dental Board, and Dr. Nielsen was not available, so he asked me to call in. We discussed HB 127 at our board meeting earlier this week, and the board feels the HB 127 addresses the concerns the dental board had with the original Senate version and that the dental board supports House Bill 127 as written.
Thank you. Are there any questions? I do not see any questions. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that would like to testify? Is this Katrina Virgin? Are you online?
Yes, hi. Good afternoon. For the record, Katrina Virgin, president of the Alaska Dental Hygienists Association. And I, of course, am calling in to provide testimony and also here mostly just to answer any questions if any questions arise during this proceeding. Yes, we definitely support the advanced practice permit all across the state. We've seen a big need that needs to be filled, and we would like to be able to practice to the extent of our licensure and abilities. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? I do not see any questions, so thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anybody else in the room or online who'd like to testify? Seeing no one in the room or online, public testimony is closed. We have a fiscal note, and we have Brenda Vincent, online, Medicaid Program Specialist, Division of Healthcare Services, and Melissa, no, we do not have Melissa Hill, but we have Sharon Walsh online. Are there questions for either of them as far as the fiscal note? Representative Telton.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. We have a fiscal note before us that's OMB component 3234 that shows a cost at implementation of this through the Alaska Health Enterprise System at $250,000. Could maybe somebody just explain that?
Ms. Vincent, would you like to respond to Representative Tilton? Oh, excuse me. Actually, one second, please. Do we have somebody from OMB here? Oh, Melissa Hills. Would you like to come up to the table and put yourself on the record?
For the record, my name is Melissa Hill. I work for Healthcare Services. Through the chair, Representative Tilton. The $250,000 is explained a couple ways. So part of that time is hours to work on claims adjudication and payment process. This is a brand new billing provider, and we haven't added one of these to the system since go live. So that cost is about $187,000. To do a provider change then, once we have it all in and get it set up as a provider, that is about 600 hours worth of time, and that comes out to $63,000.
Thank you. I guess my concern is last year, I think we had Senate Bill 105, the marital and family therapy licenses, and Senate Bill 134 was for the licensed counselor. And the fiscal notes on both of those were $50,000. So what is the difference with this one?
So the change with this one is this is creating a brand new provider type. Oh, Chair, I'm sorry, I apologize. And those were able to bill under a health group, and I think Director Gayhart's on, and Brenda Vincent can correct me on that. The difference in costs is if we're just doing a provider type change, it's about 600 hours. And the reason those were about $50,000 is because our cost per hour with the contractor has increased.
Ms. Vincent, would you like to add anything to this?
Hi. For the record, this is Renee Gayhart, Director of Healthcare Services.
Sorry.
My apologies. I just finished up with another call, but I'm happy to take that question. I also wanted to let folks know that there was a price increase on the modification hours with our contractor, as Ms. Hill had said. Between last year and this year, that's the difference between the $50,000 that you saw with the LMFTs and the $63,000 that you saw with licensed professional counselors. These particular claims will be adjudicated through the newly established ASO with Optum, their behavioral health claims. So the only cost to and through the healthcare services fiscal agent is the enrollment component. We won't be doing the claims adjudication on those, so that price wasn't included. We will be doing the claims adjudication for the dental hygienist under their new provider type.
Are there any questions? Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, through the chair, every time you add another type of provider, it's 600 hours of basically your programming. It's going into a software system and adding, say, dental hygienists as a provider, because currently they're under the umbrella of a dentist, I'm assuming. A nurse practitioner would be a provider, behavioral health, chiropractic, whatever it is. So just to add one provider, which physical therapy or whatever, each time you add one type of provider, 600 hours is pretty standard, huh?
That's Through the chair, Representative Wohl, yes, that is a standard time.
Follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just not knowing much about it. Is this sort of industry standard, or is this software particularly cumbersome?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, this is, again, Renee Gayhart, Director of Healthcare Services. This is actually one of the first times we've had this system in place with Conduent, who is our fiscal agent, since 2013. Very rarely are new provider types added to the system. Often they are added as rendering providers affiliated to a provider. So this is industry standard for implementing a new provider type or a provider ID. And yes, the 63,000 is standard for any new provider type, just for the enrollment component, and it is all of the hard coding for the system to be able to accept that provider type.
Follow up. So the additional 180,000, is that also, would that be standard in adding a provider type? And that wasn't with behavioral health, so I'm sorry. I'm sorry for asking you to repeat yourself, but can you go over the 180,000?
Through the chair, yes. That portion is for the claims adjudication. So if I can give you just a brief example. So the dental hygienists right now are paid for under the dental provider's number. They have a subset of codes that they can provide for cleaning and other items. So what claims adjudication does is ensures that as claims come through the system, they edit to ensure that that particular provider type is able to bill for those codes and are paid the correct amount for that. So claims adjudication, again, it's building logic into the system so that it pays claims appropriately and denies those that it shouldn't pay.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So would the reason that behavioral health is simpler to enter into the system is because there's fewer codes that they're billing out for. It's more of a, because hygienists are providing more individual codes of service?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, actually it's because those particular claims will now be run through the Administrative Service Organization, or Optum. They're not paid through the MMIS, which is Conduent, which is the fiscal agent that the dental hygienist will be under. So the LMFTs and the licensed professional counselors are being paid through a different system.
Thank you.
Yep. Are there any other questions? Thank you. Did you have a question?
Madam Chair, I have a question, I think, for the sponsors of the bill. Representative Sponholz, why this particular bill is, of course, designed to help underserved communities is another maybe potential benefit of this bill. Would it end up help to drive down costs put forward towards dental hygiene and things like that? Would it drive down statewide costs in any way?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, this is Representative Ivy Sponholz, House District 16. It's difficult at this point in time to project concretely any cost savings that could be result from this. But what is sort of expected is that with the people that are identified to be served by dental hygienists practicing independently, with their getting more preventative care, they're likely to need less, surgeries, removals. You know, they're going to have fewer cavities, those kinds of things, which should then save us money down the long run. That's the whole purpose of actually getting preventive dental in the first place. You might remember this last year we had a very in-depth conversation about the value of preventative dental versus, you know, sort of only, you know, emergent and treatment related dental, and we know from looking at it as a, you know, preventative dental as a whole, that it actually saves the state money. So it's our hypothesis that an investment in increasing access to preventative dental will save us money down the road.
Follow-up?
Yeah, I guess a follow-up as well. The reason why I asked that specific question is, like, I can see on this list of underserved communities that Ketchikan Indian Corporation or Ketchikan Indian Community is on the list. Mm-hmm. I know, you know, firsthand that they currently employ dentists there. Mm-hmm. So people who go there have access to dentists. Mm-hmm. Would this be an opportunity for them in the future to, rather than if a dentist leaves, hire a new dentist, would they then be allowed to hire a nurse practitioner, a dental hygienist, to fill what at one time was being done by a dentist?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, yes, they should be able to hire an advanced practice dental hygienist if this bill were to become law, and would allow them to pay that person less, which would save money in our total health care spend in the state.
Thank you. Thanks.
Either Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, following along the lines of the questions from Representative Ortiz, you mentioned it would save money in the long run. Do you anticipate if you go to an underserved area or underserved population that hasn't had a lot of basic primary dental care, hygiene, et cetera, that people will go in and find a bunch of problems that will need dental, full dentist intervention? I know every time I go to the dentist, not every time, but I often think I'm in great dental health, and they go, oh, no, we got a problem here and a problem there and a problem there and a problem there. Next thing I know, I'm lined up for a bunch of dentist appointments that I didn't really want. So I guess that's a woodwork effect, or I don't know what they call it in the dental world, a flossing effect or something. But is that in any way anticipated or accounted for?
Representative Wolf, through the chair, it is possible that if you have people that are would be getting you know, some preventative dental care and screening, they were getting cleanings and getting a, you know, superficial, you know, an initial exam, if they hadn't seen a dental health care provider in a while, that they would, we would, you know, their providers would identify potential cavities and other things that needed treatment. And so you could see sort of, you know, a short term upswing in terms of utilization, and then it's expected that it would go down again. And that short term upswing in treatment would probably save us a lot of money on the longer term, because, you know, if you get a cavity while it's small, it's a lot easier to treat, it's less expensive, it's less painful, you're less likely to have an extraction or a crown or those kinds of things. It's cheaper to do, you know, a simple you know, small cavity treatment than it is to do a crown, for example, having had a few of those myself. It's a painful and expensive project that requires several dentist visits, like, you know, so yeah.
Thank you. Do you have a question?
Not a question. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make a comment. I support this bill. I am sometimes we do things that folks on the ground see that we do not. And so I did reach out to my local hospital back in Nome, North Sound Health Corporation, and just asked them to take a look at the bill. They looked at it. They serve 15 villages in our region, and they said they like the bill, they support the bill, and so just wanted to share that with folks, and so I'll be supportive of it. Thanks.
Okay, I see no other questions. The amendment deadline is for this bill, House Bill 127, is March 9th at 5 p.m., and at this point I'll set this aside and hold it. Next, we will have House Bill 182, an act relating to the testing of sexual assault examination kits and providing for effective date. We'll have a bill reintroduction by Representative Tarr and staff to Representative Tarr, Carla Hart.
Good
Good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. Thank you for the second opportunity to come before you for this important legislation. I guess just the quick recap would be that currently our state law says that the rape kits have to be processed within 1 year, and this bill will change that to 6 months.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Seeing no questions, we will... Oh, do you have a question?
No.
We will open public testimony. And I see in the room we have Carmen Laurie. Would you come up and put yourself on the record and who you represent?
Hello. For the record, my name is Carmen Lowry, and I am the Executive Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I want to first start off by thanking you all for this opportunity. I also want to say it's a beautiful place to be and to sit. It's such a beautiful view today. The Network is a membership-based organization of 21 programs across the state who provide community-based services for victims and survivors of domestic violence. We also engage in prevention work, and of course we engage in advocacy work to create conditions where sexual and domestic violence doesn't occur, and that to make sure that victims and survivors are treated with the utmost respect when their rights have been violated. We've been working with Representative Tarr on different iterations of the Sexual Assault Kit Initiative. And on this one, we are very pleased to be able to say that we're very supportive. We support the committee substitute of this bill. What it does, the 6 months, it doesn't maybe sound like a lot. We started out last year, it was 12 months. And then once the crime lab realized that we could move to a shorter period of getting information back to survivors, Representative Tarr thought that that would be a good thing to introduce with the 6 months, and it is. And I think that what is critical to realize is what it means is that for a victim who actually goes and reports of sexual assault or sexual violence crime, during that time period before they know what happens, during that time period after they report to the law enforcement, after they go to the medical facility and undergo a forensic exam, they don't know what's going on, and things have been taken from them. And so this just reduces that period of anxiety, it reduces that period of fear, it reduces that period of anger, and it provides some relief to a victim or survivor. And it's a really strong message from the state to say, we care about you, and we're going to get this done in 6 months because we know we can do it. So I just want to thank you all for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you. Are there any questions? I would like to say yes, it's very beautiful in this room, but it'd be a lot nicer being outside.
Thank you.
The amendment deadline for House Bill 182 will be Monday, March 9th at 5 p.m. And at this point, at ease. Call this meeting back to order. Is there anybody else in the room or online? We'll be closing this public testimony. And amendments will be due to House Bill 182 Monday, March 9th at 5 p.m. And at this point, I'll set this aside and hold it over. Next, we'll have House Bill 30. Thank you all. House Bill 30, an act relating to the notice of workman's compensation death benefits, relating to the payment of workers' compensation benefits in case of permanent partial impairments, relating to the payments of workers' compensation death benefits payable to a child of an employee with there's no surviving spouse and providing for effective date. We will have a bill reintroduction by Representative Josephson and Elise Thorne-Burke, staff to Representative Josephson. Thank you, Representative Josephson, for doing the very great coughing into the sleeve.
Thank you. What was that? Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been working on that as well as studying up on my bill.
So I'm Andy Josephson. I represent House District 17 in Anchorage. And with me is my staff, Elise Sorenberg. And would you like a reintroduction to the bill and the CS in particular?
Just a brief, yes. Sure.
So it's quite simple. When a person is partially injured at work, a doctor declares whether or not they have a degree of disability. And sometimes it would be obvious to the eye, and sometimes you'd need to do further study. For example, a back injury. And we have a permanent partial impairment rating, and it's a mouthful, but basically permanent, you can't fix it. Partial, you're still alive. Impairment, that's the degree of the disability. We then have a whole body multiplier, and it's that multiplier that the bill changes because it's a 20-year-old multiplier. The effect of having a 20-year-old multiplier is to put us, and it's a little tricky to calculate because some states do it differently, but we're very likely in sort of the 40 to 50 of the 50 states placement in this category. So what we're trying to do, and your file should reflect this from last year, is move us into about 25th or 26th place. So we're not trying to set a record in terms of our generosity toward folks who have been injured permanently at work. And that's the nature of the bill. The main change the bill makes from the previous year is it deletes a category of death benefit for what I call the single childless worker. In place of that, it requires that a new worker in Alaska receive notice of their workers' comp benefits. This is designed, having talked to some members of the committee who were concerned about this new death benefit that we had in 2019 in the bill and no longer have now, this is designed to put folks on notice, hopefully, that if they are single and childless, they might want to purchase life insurance because there's no remedy for their family if they were to pass away. That's essentially what it does. It does one other minor thing. Currently under law, if someone is essentially an orphan and they're, for example, if a person were 17 or 18 years old and say their mother had already passed away and they lived with their father, and then he were to die at work, thankfully this doesn't happen often, they, under current law, would have, starting at age 19, they'd have 4 years of continuing help through the workers' comp system. But that would only be true if they were enrolled in a VOTEC program, trade school essentially, or college. And what this bill says is, let's give them that 4 years, even if they're serving in Iraq in the U.S. Marines, or if they're fishermen and they don't need to go to trade or want to go to trade school or college. In that respect, it's not going to be substantially more expensive. One could judge that as fairer in that it captures all types of different people in that roughly 19 to 23 age category. And that's what the bill does.
Are there any questions before we go on to the fiscal note? Representative Wall.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess on that point, was the initial reasoning to provide up to 22 or 23-year-old while an individual dependent was in school not earning money? Is that sort of the distinction between someone who's in school and someone who's in the workforce? Or was the other requirement that, not that they're in the workforce, but just that they're in school, and that's why they'd continue to be a dependent?
Through the chair, that, Representative Wolf, that could be. The language actually in 2330-395 is a little bit odd, and we're not changing that. But it seems to suggest someone could be 40 years old, and if they had a 65-year-old father who was still, for example, working and died at work because of a work-related accident, they could be eligible Now, it's technical because it sort of suggests that they better be enrolled at the moment of death. In other words, they better, if they're 40 and they want to continue the benefit, it might be best if they had enrolled sort of by happenstance when they were 39. So it's a little bit odd, but we're not changing that. We're just saying in this window of time from 19 to 23, this benefit, and I must tell you that the benefit is not going to be, I mean, we could take a look at that, but it's no one's going to get rich on this benefit.
Follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So you brought to mind another question of an individual who's 40 living with a parent, and the parent dies at work. Is there language for a dependent that's disabled, I guess? And I guess that's the question. A 40-year-old who lives with their parent because they can't live on their own.
Through the chair, Representative, well, actually, I'm not sure. Again, this is existing law, and the committee's welcome to look at that, but we're not tinkering with it.
Right.
But I don't think it does require that they live with their parent. However, specifically to your question, yes, there is a category in the law now so that if, for example, someone was cognitively or physically disabled, they could get their weekly allowance for a very long time. And that's true now, and it would remain true in the same way under the bill.
Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Madam Chair, Representative Josephson, you mentioned that if we were to adopt House Bill 30, it would put the state in the quote, kind of in the middle of the pack in terms of compensation for death. Is that so? Are we right now? Where are we? Are we at the very bottom?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz. So it's not compensation for death. That's a whole other matter. It's compensation for a permanent injury. Okay. So we are according. In my view, here's my answer. The Department of Labor and Workforce Development 2 years ago said that we are, for the loss of an arm from the shoulder down, very serious accident, okay, we are 32nd. For the loss of a hip, we're 33rd. Loss of an eye, 35th. Loss of an ear, 33rd. Now, you may see that number and say, well, 33rd isn't great, but it's not 45th. However, I think it really is 45th. And the reason I say that is there are about 10 or 11 states that have a totally different system of calculating it. So, for example, and this is a document straight from the Department of Labor, this page that I'm holding up shows the loss of one eye at work. And Alaska isn't even on the page. You have to flip the page to get to where it is. So, If you lose an eye at work in Maryland, your workers' comp plan will pay you $250,000, a little more. If you lose an eye here, you will receive $44,000. That's a lot less, right? It's less than 20% of what you get in Maryland.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I'd also like to note that the number we used in the bill was based on inflation as well.
So I see that Mr. Mitchell's in the room, or maybe not Mr. Mitchell.
Mr. Jordan, maybe.
Mr. Jordan, yes. Sorry, Mr. Jordan, it says Mr. Mitchell here. Oh, he's online. I'm sorry, it's me again. Mr. Mitchell is online and Mr. Jordan is here. Would you like to discuss the fiscal note?
Madam Chair, this is Gray Mitchell, the Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. I will discuss our fiscal notes. We have two fiscal notes. One deals with the workers' compensation component. And this fiscal note illustrates that there will be a revenue increase associated with increasing the permanent partial impairment benefits. and that revenue increase is estimated at $110,000 per year. And so if you look at the fiscal note for the workers' compensation component, you'll see that in FY21, it shows a $55,000 increase in revenue. And then from fiscal year 22 through fiscal years 26, it shows $110,000 in increased revenue. And this is based on the 44% increase in permanent partial impairment benefits. And the reason why that increases revenue to the division is that there are two essentially taxes. One is collected by the Division of Insurance on all premiums issued, and so that 44% increase can be expected to increase premiums in a like amount. And the other revenue source is a service fee placed on self-insured employers, such as the state of Alaska and other large employers who have the resources to self-insure. And those insurers are required to pay 2.9% of all of the indemnity benefits that they pay out over the year. And so that's where we've come up with the figures for the fiscal note. Are there any questions on that one fiscal note?
Are there any questions? I don't see any questions.
Okay. The second fiscal note deals with the second injury fund, which in Alaska, there is a fund that pays benefits for workers who have pre-existing conditions and have claims that meet certain conditions. And in order to pay those claims, there is an assessment against all of the indemnity benefits that are paid out over a year by all employers. And the assessment is based on the amount of revenue that's in the account at a given time over the year, and then the claims that are charged against the account to determine a reserve rate. And so this last year, the reserve rate was set at 5%. And so for every dollar of indemnity benefit payment, an employer is required to submit 5% to the second injury fund. And so again, based on this 44% increase, and that relates to an estimate of an increase of $4.2 million in indemnity payments. And that's based on the total amount of indemnity benefit payments that were made in 2018 multiplied by 44%. And so the estimated amount of the increase is $105,000 for FY21 and then $210,000 for fiscal year 2022 through fiscal year 2026 for each year.
Are there any questions? Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair. There's some verbiage on the second page of this fiscal note. It says studies indicate that significant benefit increases are typically accompanied by changes in claimant behavior. And then it says changes in claimant behavior might result in increased number of PPI claims. So more people are going to claim they lost an eye because they're going to get another few that. I mean, for this kind of impairment, I can't see there being extra claims. Is that, did some people really? Maybe there's claims I don't know about, like, but I would think loss of limb would be pretty hard to fake.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, that is obviously true. the National Council of Compensation Insurance had done a fairly extensive evaluation based on last year's version of House Bill 30, and this language was in that analysis. And so to the extent that it changing the benefits by such a large amount, 44% in a single year, might influence claimant behavior, it is a consideration. Obviously, it's hard to, you know, I mean, no one's going to fake the loss of an eye or something like that. But it is something that the NCCI had included in their analysis, so we included it in our fiscal note explanation.
Thank you. I just wanted to point it out.
Are there any other questions? Representative Telton. For either Mr. Jordan or Mr. Mitchell, are there any questions?
And Madam Chair, just to be clear, I know Mr. Jordan has a separate fiscal note for Department of Administration, and you know that fiscal note kind of helps to show the impact on an employer, because his fiscal note shows costs to the state associated with increasing the PPI benefit amount.
And Mr. Jordan, would you like to speak to that?
Yes. For the record, Scott Jordan, I'm the Director of Risk Management for the Department of Administration. As Director Mitchell said, our fiscal note reflects the 44% increase on what we pay out for the permanent partial impairment rating. If you look at the fiscal note, you'll see that we did a 10-year average of what we pay out, and that 10-year average, I'm sure I've got my numbers right here, that 10-year average was $979,286 a year. That does fluctuate from year to year, but that's the average. The 44% increase would increase that amount by $434,313. And then the fee that Director Mitchell was talking about is also included in there for $26,059. So the fiscal note for FY21 would be half of that, because the effective date is halfway through the year. So that'd be $230,200. And then the out years from FY22 through FY26 would be $460,400.
Are there any questions for Mr. Jordan? Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just a comment about that. We are in the odd position of wanting to see a fiscal note, because the point of the bill is to provide more benefit. But we would note that the workers' compensation annual report, and the last one is from 2018, shows total compensation payments statewide have decreased from $292 million in 2015, and now they're at $225 in 2018. Now, I don't know if that's because of our recession, or I hope it's not. I hope it's because of workplace safety. But there's been a decrease of about something close to just under $70 million in indemnity and medical benefits payments.
Are there any questions of either Mr. Mitchell or Mr. Jordan? Thank you. The amendment deadline for this will be also March 9th at 5 p.m. And at this point, I'll be setting it aside. Our next meeting will be Friday, March 6, 2020 at 9 a.m. Meeting will be here. The House Bill 187, Restrict Out-of-State Correctional Facilities. Do any members have anything before we adjourn? Okay. We will adjourn at 2:20 p.m.